Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. And this time, compared to last time I did a solo episode, this time it's semi-involuntary. I didn't have a guest. And at the same time, I started making notes and I tried to figure something out. And then I felt performance come into the picture and wear its ugly head, saying that, ooh, people seem to appreciate your last solo episode and you should do it again. Just do another one. You can do it as good. So that is bouncing around in my head, and we'll see how it plays out, basically. Just wanted to make that visible. I'm also coming from a place where I've had an experience where I need to dig deep over the past couple of days and see how that shows up in the arc that I wanted to speak into today. So if you haven't gotten it yet, it's another solo episode of mine, and we'll see how it kind of tends to play out. One of the topics that I've really been thinking about and feeling into for a while, it's been knowing. It's a topic that comes back onto the podcast, and it's, in a way, it's actually related to those lines of questioning where I'm asking and questioning and wrestling with this idea of progress. Knowing, to me, as I kind of touched upon in the episode with Joe Brewer, was that very close relationship to arrogance. Because there's a way of knowing, which is knowing over, as in power over. And there's a way of knowing, which is knowing with. And taking a stance, standing up for something, being true to yourself, being in alignment, which is completely different than that arrogant knowing, which is wanting to convince somebody, acting from fear, needing to be right, wanting to move somebody. They're very close, and they might appear, depending on your starting point or vantage point or how you're viewing it, they might appear as the same or similar or a little bit of both, which I tend to think that they both are. The knowing, in a way, to me, has to do with it's important to know, to have the courage to know. And it's important to find your way into I don't know from a position of knowing. And I don't know that is delivered from a position of never having known or never having felt that you knew or never having reflected on a topic in a way as if you knew is a very different starting point for discussion than I don't know that comes out of deep reflection and deep work and deep focus. And I do think that we need more of people that dare to take a stance, that dare to believe in what's right for them or senses to be right for them, what sits right with them, what their intuition says is right for them, and at the same time has the courage to, especially when they've accrued some sort of position or status, go out and say, and yet I don't know. So much power in that I don't know. There's so much attraction, at least for me, in that I don't know. It's that I don't know, which is delivered from a place of having known or having an idea or having a direction, is deeply attractive to me. It is an invitation to come explore together. It's that part of an exploration, which is not safety, not trust, but it's the adventure part. It's like the, hey, let's go find out. And in that type of knowing, I also feel like there is a certain type of competition, which is to further, to win more together, you know, to just play that infinite game and infinite rounds. And just knowing that as long as we keep playing, we're going to keep winning. But it does mean that in each round we'll compete. But it's not to exterminate. It's not to extinguish. It's not to extinct. But rather it's a continued competition. It's a sharpening. It's a deepening. It's a widening. It's an omnidirectional increase, if you will, a densification, like an increase of density of the field. So from that knowing, it takes me into that favorite question. Well, I don't hear it as much anymore, actually. It seemed to be a fad that passed over a little bit, but that question of purpose and the question of intention. I really like, don't get me wrong, I really like this idea of putting your intention out with a meeting or with a specific thing. And at the same time, as I'm working my way through these spiritual communities, these different education communities, these different communities that are trying to improve the world, there's also this, what I believe to be a little bit of a misunderstanding or a cop-out of, not cop-out, I shouldn't say cop-out. It's more a misunderstanding, or it's a little bit of a, we think, we behave as if our purpose or as if our intention is all that matters. So I come from the world of material science, as you might know, and there, if we are putting tension on a material, especially a polymer, long chain polymer, which is a good analogy actually for this, then what happens is that you put this tension, and if you do it too fast, it's going to break. It goes, and then it breaks. If you do it slowly, up to a certain point, you can actually extend the material. And if you hold it there, if you're willing to stay in that uncomfortable extended position, then after a while, the molecules will relax and reorganize themselves into this new normal. So it'd be like a relaxation. And after that relaxation, you can actually go a little bit further, intense it a little bit more. And you can hold a little bit more force, a little bit more power. And then you can keep going for a little bit. And eventually you'll string it out and so forth. So there are unintended quantities. You can't go forever unless you like refill the material base and so forth. But there's still that idea that the intention and the extension are one movement, bidirectional, goes in two directions at least at the same time. And if we ignore one, then the other one doesn't go very far. So if we do the intention without the willingness or the preparation or the nervous system preparation into extension, to be able to extend, to prepare our system to perform, to extend, then we can have all the intention in the world and it's not going to move us. So the movement is created from that bidirectional movement. It's not just from clarity on your intention or on your purpose. It's not enough, at least not in my experience. So, no, I'm speaking from experience. I'm not saying, I'd love to have a challenge on that. And I would love to hear what it invokes in you, because I'm venturing out into territory that I'm kind of test talking into. So, yeah, I'm caveating in that way. But it's not, this is not an I don't know for me. It's a, I think I know. It feels true to me. And so that intention and extension kind of brings me into another thing that I've been playing with quite a bit, and I think I played with in the last solo episode as well, was maps. And one of them is, of course, the gender map of the masculine and the feminine. The other one is, could be the developmental psychology map of the Keegan 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Integral is a type of map. And I've been, over the past year or so, following on the sideline, not very passionately, but nonetheless, been following this debate about whether it's time for us to scrap the developmental maps, as Nora Bateson puts it. And I'm really curious about that. And the way that I see these maps, given their intention, given that they have an intention or seem to have an intention, many of them, not all, given that the directionality of these maps seem to be in one way, it's not sort of bidirectional or multidirectional, you are moving roughly upwards or intending to move upwards. I kind of felt come down on Nora's side. And I think in general, what I'm trying to say here is that there's this analogy that I've been using in conversations and it seems to kind of hit home for people. And so what I think we need to do is to come off the map into the territory. It's really time that we come off the map and into the territory. And why do I say that? Well, I recently read an article by, I think, Robert, but his last name is Chia. I wrote it in 2017. It's a pretty heady piece about building organizational culture as wayfinding, running operations as wayfinding. And it has to do with this map making, because what he's talking to is exactly what kind of my analogy captures. And so what I'm saying is, like, we have these maps. We have this general direction. It's important to have a map to look at, to take a look at, to like scope and gauge the landscape. But the first thing that I will say, which is kind of probably the most fundamental thing, is like whenever you pick a map, at least for myself, I make sure that I pick a map maker that is passionate, just absolutely passionate about making maps. I don't want a map maker that is wants to get me to a certain place, that owns a resort at the end of the map. That's not what I want. I don't want the map maker to sell me anything. I want the map maker to be absolutely passionate about making the map. And so what's the passion of the person that's made the map that you're following? What's their self-interest in it? What nervous systems have made that map that you're following? Is there intention? Is there direction? Is there any interest to work the map? And the map might still be absolutely fine as long as you know what it is. And then on top of that, the next one is that as I start moving in nature, so here in Iceland, if I would, it's scoped up my line, I know where I'm going, I have my skis in my back, I have my equipment, I've prepped. I've taken out my direction, I'm oriented. In order to start moving, I put that map away. And then I move in the territory, stone by stone by stone, by grass by grass by grass, by sheep by sheep by sheep, through the underbrush, around the forest, you know. I navigate in the landscape, off the map. Map is in my pocket securely, and I'm just using it as a rough guide. And if I walk far, if I can't sort of orient or keep the whole thing in my head and keep comparing to that mental landscape that I think is going on, unless I'm seeing differences that actually make a difference in my navigation, I'll just keep walking without the map and I'll just be in the territory. But that's going to be objectively keep me safer. If I try to walk along the map, I'm going to be stumbling. I'm going to be falling off cliffs. I'm going to be falling off rocks. I'm going to be stubbing my feet and toes and I might walk into swamps or whatever it might be. You're getting the point, right? And then if I need to stop and pick up the map again, I can't pick up the map and assume that I know where I am. I need to re-navigate, reorient myself from first principles, basically. And how often do we do that in our developmental maps? How often do we do that in the masculine and the feminine? How much benefit of a doubt do we give ourselves? Or each other? How often do we assume that because we are one thing in one situation, we are the same thing in the next situation, in the other context, with the other people? And how much of a prisoner are we to that type of thinking? And that kind of comes to the violence of the maps. It's like the curious versus the strategic map maker, and also the curious versus the strategic map reader. And if it seems high flying, I mean, I can take a very concrete example. In the LCA, the life cycle analysis, are we making life cycle analysis to curiously explore how our product behaves, or are we trying to make an LCA to make our product look good? Those are two very different LCAs. Two other examples that might be relevant if you don't have an experience with LCAs, it's the male-female thing. So Male seems to correspond to male bodies. Female thing seems to correspond to female bodies. And what are the assumptions that we make when we impose those assumptions onto people working around in those bodies? So a male person shows up, a male body shows up, and how does he relate to his masculinity doesn't necessarily say so much about that. But we make assumptions. And the same thing goes for feminine, the female body that shows up. How does she relate to the feminine? How is she supposed to relate to the feminine? These maps are extremely relevant on the aggregated level. However, they're only relevant if we start relating them to the reality that we think that we live in, to the individual that we impose them on. The third example that I wanted to bring in as well would be that idea of the developmental maps. What color are you? How far have you progressed? What rights do I have if I have progressed further than you have? So those are ways of when we get confused between the map and the territory and the type of generalizations or ideas or labels that we can put on our fellow human beings. If we forget that maps are just maps. One last point that I wanted to make in this, just to make it even more relevant, why I'm speaking about this at this point, is the algorithms that's surrounding us. So algorithms is a way of modeling, and modeling is a way of map making. It's automated, and so it means that the map makers are the ones that are feeding into these things that then do their own thing with them. And these things are then feeding us information. So that is actually rearranging our consciousness, our way of relating to the world, our way of understanding the world. So they're feeding in raw data, or what we perceive to be raw data, into our map making and our own model making and our own sense making. And so there is a real worry around the opacity of these parts, of these models, of these algorithms that we are interrelating with. And so therefore, this map making that I'm speaking of is not some dusty old maps in the library or some paper map that you bring out with you on your adventure into the mountains, but rather it's the stuff that you sense make and that you work with every day. These are shaping the tools that we work with. And a lot of that tool, a really important tool, is our cognition. And that cognition is shaped by the input data and it's learning. It's a learning system. It's a self-organizing learning system dedicated to certain things. And so if we don't understand the maps that we are interacting with, then how are we going to be able to sense make, to relate, to contrast, to inquire into them? Returning to that initial part where we would be on or off the map, and that idea that we need to come off the map, there's also a certain level of trust or of confidence that would be inherent, required even, in order to be able to come off the map. That's a certain skill level that you have when you know that you can put the map away and trust that you're going to be moving in generally the right direction and make generally the right decisions. So that's a specific skill that you've made, or you do it in company, you do it with other people. If you do it in community, you can kind of sense make together and work away and like, oh, you saw that ridge and this thing and that thing. And what if, you know, should we be doing this or that? Or like, where's the wind coming from? And you're adapting constantly to the circumstances in order to find the best way to where you think you need to go. And you're also open to really remake those decisions if the territory doesn't look like the map or the conditions are worse. And I believe that move off the map to be really important, if not even fundamental. That kind of takes me off to another point, which is currently, it seems to be a little bit beside the topic that I've been on. Well, actually, maybe not. Because if we are thinking of maps as an orienting tool, and then we are thinking of what orients us. I think Thomas Bjorkman mentioned in a previous episode that fear is a really important part. It's a really important emotion, orienting emotion. And I can really see the truth in that fully. And I can also see that unless we have metabolized that fear and really dealt with it and let it come through and flow through our system and get unstuck, it might hold us or color us or teleologically move the entire, whatever we're trying to build through a frequency of fear. And so I'll return to my other go-to guy at the moment, which is Nate Hagins, and his podcast, The Great Simplification. I know I plugged it last time too. It's still very present. But he has this spiel that he does about the power principle. And so when he's talking about the power principle, he says that biological organisms orient towards power. And power is energy per time, the maximum amount of energy per time. And I had this really sort of blatant experience of it as we were, me and my wife went to see the volcano, the new volcano in Iceland a few months back now, I think. And we were sitting there and this volcano was moving and it's this magical thing. That's immense amount of power that's coming out of this. You know, it's, you can feel the heat, you see it moving, you see it bubbling, you see this mysterious magical thing. And what happened was that there was one of the pathways for the lava broke. And so there was lava that was spilling out, like new hot lava that was spilling out towards us as we were sitting. We were sitting far up on the mountainside, like way far from fumes and, you know, on the right side of the wind and all of that stuff. Taking care of that. But it was pouring hot lava towards us. And then all of a sudden, all these people, which was at that point, it was a couple thousand probably on that mountainside. Many people just started moving towards it instinctively. Most of them kind of caught themselves and said like, ooh, wait, hold on, what's going on here? And at the same time, many just kept moving towards that power. It's as if they were hypnotized by it. And of course, this is my projection into this particular point, but it was very blatant at the time how that works. And I'm wondering if we have fear on one end of that spectrum and power on the other end of the spectrum, especially these days when we are afraid of power or we have lots of opinions of power, whether it's good or bad or what it makes us and doesn't make us and how it's identity forming or not identity forming or whatever it might be. How does power come onto the map and orient us? And what does it take from us in order to metabolize power, that desire for power, to not grab, if you will, Excalibur? Because you could have all the power in the world and you know that you're good, right? Or do you? And in a way, I also have this old Emerge podcast where Bonita Roy, I think, is making a source code analysis of power, which I think is brilliant. So if you want to find that and dig deep into it, just do it. And you can also call me on if I'm misquoting it. But one of the things that she defined power as was the ability to move others. I think that's really, really important. Speaking of arrogance and knowing and purpose and intention and maps, right? How do we move others? And who has the right? And how do we have a right to move others? At what cost? And what cost does it come to on our end? If it comes from a place of knowing, if it comes from a place of service, if it comes from a place of whatever place it might be, are we moving others through that imitation, through that I don't know, that firm, directed I don't know, which is an imitation for discovery, or are we moving others through force, by threat? Are we moving others by promising them ends, a specific outcome that they would be okay? Are we taking responsibility? Are we alluring them with something, attracting them with something? I don't know. But I think those are important questions. And this power principle is sort of in the background there. Like, how do I actually relate to power? What does it mean? And, you know, I have these shadows that I've been working through around progress, around putting myself out there, around taking a stance, showing something, and all of that stuff, which I see are themes that are coming back. And at the same time, I think in a way, one way or the other, they all relate to, or some part of it relates to power. Now I said stepping out, being seen, is one part of power. And of course, as soon as I say that, the opposite appears. The remaining hidden, staying unseen. The conforming, the staying in service, as in the player in the orchestra that does their job by remaining invisible. There's a certain type of art, certain type of dance, certain type of movement, certain type of power that you can also express by conforming fully and sinking fully back into the group. And that, I think, is relating to something really profound as well. It's relating to different worldviews, different paradigms. And as I was speaking to Thomas Brunn, he mentioned that the type of facilitation that he has to do to an Asian group, a Chinese group particularly, or a Chinese expat group, is very different from what he needs to do to the individualist, more individualist, to the Western Europeans. The Western Europeans often need a softer bringing in to and appointing to the collective, whereas the Chinese in his story really needed a reminder of who they were, of the individuality. Like, it speaks to what Thomas Steininger and Elizabeth de Bold are speaking of and have discovered, that we're working with different levels of individuation. That is the pre-individuated, the individuated, and then the trans-individuated, which moves us from the personal into the interpersonal, into the intersubjective. And then if we put power into that, or rather our view of power, or the particular view of power that is holding us, that we are holding, and how we're relating to that, a relationship to power, how we dare to step into it, step up to it. Again, it's identity forming. What does it make? What does it make me? What does it make us? What are the affordances? What are we allowed to do? What are we not allowed to do? What is culturally determined? What is family-orientedly determined? What is genetically determined? It's the trifecta of the Batesonian, again, like these three things that govern most things: the genetics, the culture, and the personality, or something, the groups that we interact with. And then I'm holding this other perspective as power being dark. Now I need to be clear. I'm not talking about immature dark. I'm just talking about power, that capability to move a lot of those sort of the dark triad, like all of those things that we put in the dark spectrum of our emotions. They tend to be laced with a certain probability that you will move people, a certain invitation to power. And if we would call being light, so like in our being, there is light. And as soon as we are presented with the power, we have this darkness that's looming. And the question is, how do we weave it? What can we hold? Which holds what, if you will? I think also Thomas Berkman was saying, is your fear holding you, or are you holding your fear? Which I think is a useful way of thinking about it. Yet I would point to that it somehow, at least for me, it reads like you'd have control over something, which is not necessarily what I think is the right discernment principle. It's not control, but it's a capacity to be with. I think that would be the light way of holding that type of power, that fear would be. And power then as the ability to move people. The ability to be with something would be, I mean, sexual power is obvious, I think, but are you willing to be with that in integrity, in discernment, pure? And are you able to integrate it with your being, into your being? Are you able to own your shadow? You know, are you coming into that shadow knowing, or thinking that you know? Is that an embodied sensation, or is it something that you know in your mind? Are you in the idea space, or are you in the embodied space? And I'm painfully aware right at this moment of recording that there is so much more for me to embody, to move in owning my shadows, owning my fears, owning my nervous system programming, owning my trauma, if you will. And I want to try talking to, I'm trusting my notes here, I'm trusting the map that I drew for myself because I knew that it was a curious map maker that made it. And so the prompt that I gave myself was information from a cybernetics lens. So there is this piece from cybernetics, which is really influential to me. And this is really at the edge of my thinking, so I don't quite know how it weaves into this, but it's around information. And it's around information being all of those things that we are not looking for. So information is always all of the stuff that is not happening. One of the examples that Gregory Bateson puts in his book, Steps to an Ecology of Mind, is there's a puzzle. You're looking at all the surrounding pieces of the puzzle piece that's missing. And that is informing the formation. So you can deduce the puzzle piece shape from that. And something that I was feeling as I was reading into this was that this is really how I live my life. The way that I experience my life being lived at the moment, and this is new to me, is the way that I would explain it is almost like it's infinite potential. And then I take a step. And that step was just all of the steps that I didn't take. So it's like an exclusion of all the stuff that didn't happen. And then I take another step. And then I take another step. And it has to do with this map making and the reorienting. And it's continuous. And it's ongoing. And it's constant. And it's very profound. And another way to describe that is, of course, the focus on the what things aren't doesn't necessarily tell us much about what things are. In order to find out what things are, we need to find out multiple points of what things aren't. Sounds technical, but it's like you're in an argument and somebody says, or I say, that was not very kind of you. And the other person says, oh, so are you saying that I'm manipulative? And I'm saying, no, I'm saying that was not very kind of you. Oh, so are you saying that I'm an evil person? It's like, no, I'm saying that was not very kind of you. And so as long as I stick to this particular point to what it wasn't, it's an exclusion of a number of things, but it's not necessarily saying what it is. And so I know that my life isn't a lot of things. However, not yet sure fully as to exactly what it is, what it amounts to. But that exploration, again, in things that it is not, is very rewarding. It's very interesting. It's very curious making. It's very open because there are so many possibilities and you can constantly live in that potential and then something materializes. And then you know, then you found out. There is also a weak connection, I sense, with the Kinevan framework between the, can't remember what the first steps is, but it's definitely a complicated, complex, and chaotic world that we're talking about. And we are currently, I think, in pretty chaotic times. And in that navigation, in that last piece of navigation, when the chaos has occurred, then you actually have to act in order to be able to gain information. Action becomes information. So action and moving in the world and the responses to that action in the world actually gives you information, i.e. it shows you what things weren't. It's really important though, or it seems important at the moment. That's the thought that I'm kind of trying on, is that even though it says a lot about what things weren't, I'm not so sure that it says a lot about what things are. That's where the openness comes in. That's where we need to hold that potential, hold that openness, stay open, stay in that. And as one of my mentors just recently said to me, it's like that openness sometimes comes at a cost of wounding. But for him, and I think I'm kind of learning the same, I share his sentiment, which is having spent a lifetime open, or at least part of a lifetime open, and the woundings that those result in, just knowing that those wounds are also gifts. Those wounds, if we tend to them intelligently, they yield much more than the wounding ever gave. And they give us insight, and they give us maturity, and they give us view into things that we didn't think we could possibly live into, or potentially that we didn't have access to. And it has to do with that peace. And so if I can rest in the fact that my life, the things that actually happen in my life, is always a result of all the things that didn't happen, of all the things that I didn't do, then that does something for how I relate to my shadow. It does something for how I relate to power. It does something for how I relate to knowing. And so as I do things, things happen and take form through me. Those are consequences of a number of correlating factors. And these correlating factors are, of course, then something that I'm a victim of. So it almost comes back to that sort of argument of agency. And I know that I've used that quote a lot, but I'm going to say it again. It's like that part where the paradox of agency is that you have no agency unless you believe that you have no agency. Then you have a little. Which would go for free will, which would go for what we are able to do, what we are able to say, what we're able to think. And so what I'm trying to say is that what we are able to think is not a result of what we're actually able to think. We're not thinking the next thought. We're just not thinking a lot of different thoughts. And so we're constantly looking at that puzzle, and our organism is constantly looking at that puzzle for us and identifying the missing piece. And there's no other piece at that given moment in that given nervous system that could occur. And so that's an invitation, I think, to compassion. And it's an invitation, perhaps, even to, which is what I'm reading from Bateson, Gregory Bateson, for listening, for deep listening, moving and listening as the practice. Trying to navigate, wayfind rather than navigate, actually, to be correct in Chia's terminology, to wayfind your way through a landscape. It's a practice of listening and moving, and listening and moving. And if listening is too narrow, then maybe sensing. And trusting that intuition, that implicit, that signal that comes up in the middle of all the noise that your body is telling you is a difference that's going to make a difference, to listen to that. And have the courage to act in accordance with it, to exercise your discernment, to break free of the cultural colonial protocol that we are actually all embedded in. And if we are following that practice of listening and moving, we're also breaking free of, which I think is another topic that I've touched upon a couple of times throughout the podcast, which is this idea of our protocols in the West being so oriented towards communication, and us being so enamored by or attracted by or swept away by communication, excellent communication by people, even psychopaths, are sweeping us away, and we're staying with the thing of, but he said so, she said so, but he said he wasn't lying. But she said he wasn't lying. And at the same time, the resonance in our body, our entire system is telling us that we knew. On some level, we knew. And at that particular point, it was impossible for us to see that piece of knowing because we didn't want to see it. Because our intention, our purpose was different. And our intention and purpose carried us because we didn't want to extend ourselves. And so we thought, someone else could extend it for us. And we could reach a little further together. And we were subject to wishful thinking and part of a colonial protocol and stuck in a paradigm which only prioritizes communication and doesn't really communicate or prioritize how you move in the world. So I think that's almost a nice starting point for a wrap up. This one felt a lot less clear, but I think what I have been talking about is not knowing as a driver for exploration, not knowing as a source of power, not knowing as a way of getting yourself off of the map and into the territory and start navigating, start looking. And as you start looking, just because it's marked as a stone doesn't mean that it has to be a stone. Just because it's marked as a peak, it doesn't mean that it has to be a peak. You have to investigate nature as it is. You have to investigate the people around you as they are. If they come in a male body, doesn't mean that they are not also in a feminine energy. Just because they come in a feminine body doesn't mean female body, doesn't mean the other, that they don't have a male energy. It doesn't mean that one is more natural to them. It doesn't mean that they're more skilled at one or the other. Or it probably means that they're more skilled at one or the other, but it doesn't mean that the one you think you have them mapped onto would have to be, you have to be curious there. I've talked about not knowing as an excuse to hide or as a radical stance taking where with an impulse to explore. We talked about the power principle and the shadows that's connected to power and our ability to move others. All of the questions around how do we move people? Who has a right? What residue lies around in our nervous systems and why are we moving? Which whys are activated as we are moving into the world and starting to move people or try to move people? Which ways of attracting people are attractive now? If you do it truly non-violently with the nervous systems that we have currently in the West, who is attracted by that? And if people aren't attracted, if enough, quote unquote, I'm really doing air quotes there, people don't show up to the thing that you have to offer from the place you have to offer it, does that then mean that you should go and play the game? Because you know that you are a being of whatever, light, force for good, all of that stuff. And if you think you know, how do you know? And I'm saying you, and I'm asking those questions to myself because that's what I'm struggling with. Like, how can I know? And the only reason I can know is if I have attachment or not attachment, how hard it plays out in me. And just when I think that I'm starting to become a little bit freer, another level of stuckness seems to unravel. So I'll say very little about that. But fundamentally to me, it is about the adventure, the lust for adventure. And in order to go on that adventure, you need some camaraderie. You need to find that safety either in yourself, in your own capabilities, or in community, and maybe both. You need to also trust your own skills and trust your toolkit, trust your way of moving in the world and your capability, the resources that you have built that you carry with you. And then you go on that adventure. And the adventure in itself is an adventure because you don't know how it will end, how far you will get. If you reach the top of the mountain or halfway up the mountain, or if you get all the way over or not, doesn't mean you don't have a plan. It doesn't mean you don't have a map. But once you're in the adventure, you need to be completely responsive and completely embedded in your surroundings. And there's no separation there. If there's separation there, you are, at least I know from my experiences of being in the wild, that you're typically end up in a world of problems. So with that little meandering and not very peppy endpoint, then again, who says that an endpoint has to be peppy? I'll leave it. And if you want to find out more about me, you can go to my webpage. I'll leave that in the show notes and shoot me an email. Or reach out on social media. If you feel like reaching out to me and giving me a shout out, what you heard, what came alive for you during my little meandering exploration, I would love to hear it. And if you don't, that's fine too. And regardless, hopefully I'll see you next week with a guest. But we'll see. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you.